Hi everyone, this is Dr. Eric Fields. To learn more about my approach to overcoming any kind of addiction and living your best life, check out my new book on Amazon.com, The New Trend of Solving Addiction Problems. This book will take you step by step through my process of beating an addiction or any compulsive behavior and really changing yourself. I am confident that you will find this book truly resourceful and invaluable. So, I thought the first podcast would really focus on what it means to have an addiction. And, you know, I feel like this word has gotten so many negative connotations. One thing that you will learn about me is I am an alternative therapist or an alternative psychologist or practitioner in the sense that, you know, I don't subscribe to the belief that an addiction is a disease. And I don't subscribe to this kind of one-size-fits-all treatment approach, especially here in America, where basically if you have any kind of addiction, you know, people say that the way to go is the 12-step programs or the anonymous groups. And, you know, you better believe that no matter what kind of addiction you have, there is an anonymous group for that nowadays. So, if you're talking about, of course, where it all started, alcohol abuse, there's Alcoholic Anonymous, drug abuse, Narcotics Anonymous. If you eat too much, Overeaters Anonymous, gambling problems, Gamblers Anonymous. I don't know the exact title, but there's one for what they call sexaholics or people with sex addiction. So there's a group for that as well. And there's a bunch more. The first thing I should say is I'm not against anonymous groups. If they help you and you find them valuable, then, you know, that's great. If they're a helpful resource for you, then excellent. There's a couple things or philosophies about these groups that I don't agree with at all. I don't agree that everybody who has a problem with either X, Y, or Z needs to be abstinent. Many of us have problems with all sorts of things in our life and we don't give them up. We learn to cope with them and deal with them. And, you know, well, the best example I can come up with is, you know, people who are kind of addicted to food, right? So this is always a very interesting thing to me, and for a while there I specialized in eating disorders because I always found it very interesting that, you know, if you have some kind of compulsion or some kind of a dependency on a substance that's not, you know, required for sustenance, you know, for survival. You have, and I use this in quotes, the luxury of giving it up. You know, you don't have to drink alcohol. I know some of you would say, oh, well, there's studies out there that show red wine will help if you're with your heart and this and that, and that's true, but you don't need it, you know. And certainly some of those benefits from red wine, you can probably get in a vitamin these days. And you definitely don't need to gamble. It would be a less than satisfying life if you didn't have sex, but you don't absolutely need that either. But you do need to eat. And it's very interesting because, you know, in all these anonymous groups, they preach abstinence. But in the Overeaters Anonymous group, obviously, you cannot preach abstinence because you cannot say that people have to stay away from food. That's impossible. We need food. So, it's interesting. You know, certain things that we could become, quote, addicted to, we can't, you know, give up. So what does that mean? That means we have to learn how to moderate that. Now, there are special challenges with mind-altering substances because, you know, when your judgment is compromised, it's very hard to, you know, deliberately make efforts at reducing the consumption or, you know, being in a rational mind that can say I've had enough or, you know, this is a place I don't want to be at, you know, our judgment is compromised. Although I will say that, you know, for people, especially with binge eating disorder, that overeat to such a degree, there is an endorphin rush. And it is almost associated with this kind of loss of control. So I don't want to say that, you know, if you eat an entire cake, you know, your judgment's going to be compromised in terms of, you know, saying, oh, I'm really cake wasted and I'm not going to be able to eat them. I'm not going to be able to refuse to, you know, any more of these kind of high calorie foods. But it is interesting that to some degree, you're not in your most rational mind. At least that's what's been suggested by some of the biological studies that have been done on the effects of, you know, binging with food and overeating. So, for me, I believe that many, many people that are struggling with some kind of addiction can actually learn to use that more moderately. And I'm also, you know, I'm in a select group of practitioners. And I don't mean that to sound cocky, like, you know, we're this, you know, very select know-it-alls or anything of that nature. What I mean by select is there aren't many of us. I should use the word minority. I am in a minority of practitioners that are not really into the whole disease model concept. We don't really buy into that. We don't think that abstinence is the only way. We don't think that you need to go to an anonymous group to get better if you've ever had any kind of issues with any kind of addiction. And, you know, we also believe that one can make progress in their mental health and their psychological well-being without cutting back at all. You know, it up until this point in time, you know, it's been kind of standard practice in addiction therapy that, you know, in order to get treated, in order to address the underlying psychological factors or the co-occurring psychological reasons for, you know, your addiction and everything else, or the other problems that it has created for you, that you need to be abstinent. In fact, many therapists would turn you away if you weren't abstinent or you didn't agree to that rule. In our approach, you know, it really comes down to the client or the patient, whatever, you know, I use those two words interchangeably, but whatever is meaningful progress to you. And yes, I do believe you can make progress without cutting down at all. And I've seen it happen. I've seen patients not cut down at all and make progress in terms of coping with things better. And starting to be more open and talk about some past trauma or, you know, difficulties that they've had, not related to the substance abuse necessarily, but things that the substance abuse is definitely medicating or helping them cope with. And I've seen these people get a lot better just in that regard. Now, I will say it's very rare for a patient of mine to start making that kind of progress and then still not eventually cut down, you know. But my point is that in order to make progress in any area, be it psychological, be it your job, whatever other co-occurring issues and difficulties you're having, it's not a prerequisite for you to cut down on your substance use or whatever addictive behavior you're doing. Now, of course, if you're using on the job, I would argue that, yeah, that's going to be very hard to make progress on the job, you know, in that kind of situation. But in general, what I'm talking about is it's not necessary. And, you know, that, you know, you can still make progress in other areas in your life without cutting down at all. And, you know, I have my own personal philosophy. It's called the leverage philosophy. And that is sometimes when a person, they're relying on a substance too much, let's say mainly for psychological reasons or maybe even a physical dependency, and it's just not an ideal time for them to cut back on their use, and they just feel like, you know, not only do they have these substance use issues, but they also have, you know, job issues, marital issues, family issues, school issues, I mean, all sorts of difficulties, you know, financial issues, all these different things, you know, that are all intertwined and interrelated. And so a lot of times, you know, with my leverage philosophy, I'll explain to the patient that if we can start with an area, the first area in your life that is most amenable to change, the one that we can start to see progress in the soonest or the quickest, that if we can start with that and you start to make progress in one area in your life, and I know it's going to sound really silly, but let's say the person has poor personal hygiene and they're not brushing their teeth at night, they're not taking showers, and that is the one thing, the easiest thing in their life at this time for them to make progress in. That, okay, you know, I don't really feel like doing anything, I'm depressed, I don't have no money, I got this, I got that, I'm drinking or using all the time, but yeah, you know, I think I might be able to start getting into a good personal hygiene and some good habits of brushing my teeth every day and taking a shower. And it sounds so silly, but do you know, when you start making progress in one area in your life, it overflows into other areas in your life. It is like that concept of energy breeding energy. You know, we start getting on a roll, we start making progress, and before long, we're ready to take on other challenges. And so maybe we get that under control, and then maybe, you know, maybe the next issue is starting to work on repairing some of their relationships. And then maybe, you know, with that, we can then start working on reducing the substance intake. And then when we start making a little progress with that, maybe they're actually ready to take on a job again if they had lost one or they're out of work. You know, we cut down the substance use enough so that maybe it's only occurring at night, and they're able to work a day job, and, you know, they start working that day job. And it, you know, this is not to say that, you know, we work on one issue, totally make all the necessary progress in that one area, and then we switch to another one. No, we can go back and forth. We make enough progress in their substance use that we restricted only to nighttime use. Now they're able to go to work. Now they're feeling good, let's say, they're feeling more competent, they have a job, they're feeling more skilled, they're getting some compliments. Now they feel even better to make more progress. So guess what? Maybe we go back to making even more reductions to their substance use so that it's not occurring every day. You know, according to, you know, the philosophy of anonymous groups and so much of the medical establishment here in the States, you know, this kind of thinking is just, you know, surreal. You know, it's not believable that you know, a patient could actually make progress like this and do this. And I've had success stories that it's shocking. I mean, literally, I've had patients come in and say they're drinking all this much, they don't understand why, and we set up a plan, and all of a sudden, within a couple weeks, they've already significantly reduced their drinking, and they're saying to me, "Dr. Fields, I really can't believe how much easier this is than I thought it was. You know, my drinking was just so habitual. I never really paid attention to exactly what was going on when I was drinking. I wasn't self-monitoring. I wasn't paying attention to cues. I wasn't using strategies so that, you know, I wasn't kind of compelled to drink. or you know, these environmental manipulations, like, you know, having these kind of positive activities throughout the day that I could plan to make it less likely for me to drink. Or what I always love to use are these incompatible activities, like, you know, chances are you're not gonna play tennis if you're drunk. I mean, you could do it, but chances are you're not gonna wanna do it because you're not feeling coordinated and it's just not something you're gonna wanna do. But if you know you have a tennis match, tennis lessons, and you go in there and you're playing tennis that day, you know, that's an incompatible behavior. You know, most people, even people with, you know, severe alcohol disorders, are not going to engage in those kind of rigorous physical activities drunk. You know, they're either going to drink and cancel, or they're going to go do that activity and not drink. So we call these incompatible behaviors, you know. You can't do one, you know, while doing the other. And they're not perfectly incompatible, because like I said, I know you can still do it if you really wanted to, but the chance is less likely. So, you know, those are, you know, just some quick ideas about the approach that I use and that a lot of us use who are this select group that we call harm reduction therapists. You know, the title is very simple. It's a lot simpler than my my podcast title. It's a lot less lengthy than that. And basically, that's exactly what it means. It's reducing harm. And we use that word harm as all-encompassing. You know, we're talking about psychological harm, physical harm, emotional harm, harm to family, you know. We use that in a very broad way. If I have an intravenous drug user and they're using dirty needles or sharing needles, and we get them to only use clean ones, that is progress. That is a reduction in harm, right? Because we've lowered their potential of getting, a disease such as hepatitis or HIV or what have you. So we reduce the harm in that way. So, you know, in America, I feel like this approach, this philosophy is very new. It's very controversial. You know, I feel like, you know, people look at us like we're taking on AA and NA and all those anonymous groups, and you know, you know, we're this camp poised to fight them, and it's really the opposite. To be honest with you, the anonymous groups have a major issue with our philosophy. We don't have such an issue with their philosophy. There are certain points we disagree with, and some of the ones I went over, and I'll go over a few others. But we don't disagree with them being an option in terms of a source of support and a way that some, you know, methods that someone could use to help them overcome their dependency. I mean, statistically, the efficacy of these programs is very low. I think it's around, you know, not much more than 10%. And it could even be lower than that, because you always have to, you know, think about all the people that choose not to partake in these surveys, especially when you're dealing with, you know, trying to get people to participate in a survey about a program where you're supposed to remain anonymous. So even if the survey, you know, the interviewer or the person giving the survey is saying that this is strictly confidential and anonymous, there could always be some concerns about that. But regardless, we're really dealing with a very low efficacy rate for these programs. So my whole point is, what is available to the rest of the population of people that have these kind of addictive disorders? The 90%, the large majority, let's even say that. What's available to them? There's not much. You know, they go to their physician, they get told, you need to go to an anonymous group. And if they don't like the idea or the philosophy of the anonymous groups, or they don't like talking about their problems with a group of strangers, and they don't find it beneficial, or especially if they don't, you know, they're not totally sold on the idea of giving the substance up, because that's kind of a requirement of these programs, then what do they do? They suffer in silence, and they get no help. They get no treatment. And then how about all those therapists that they're going to seek out that are going to say, the only way I'm treating you is if you go to an anonymous group and or you swear, solemnly swear, that you're going to be abstinent. And for those honest people who are like, well, I can't swear to that. I'm not really totally ready to give that up. Where do they go? They don't get help. That's what happens. They don't make any progress. So it's a real shame, you know, that's the only kind of model we have to help people here. A model that's not really based off of, well, it's not based off scientific research or any kind of real research in terms of their techniques. You know, the therapeutic approaches that us harm reduction therapists use, you know, are research validated techniques. They're techniques that have been found to work. Whether a social worker or a psychologist or a psychiatrist practicing as a harm reduction therapist, you know, you're using research validated techniques, techniques you learned in graduate school. The techniques that were developed in the anonymous groups were developed by Bill Wilson, and Bill Wilson was a stockbroker who thought these strategies were good, but there's nothing to say that they are good. And a 10% efficacy rate is not that great. And you know, so that's to say that the 12 steps may have absolutely, you know, let's just look at the 10% for what it works for, right? The 12 steps may have absolutely nothing to do with the reason why this 10% gets better. And I hate to state, you know, the obvious, but some of these people may get better just on their own. So in other words, sure, they were in an anonymous group at the time that they got better, but maybe they got better just because, you know, their own thinking changed, or friends or family members helped them or influenced them. And how many of these 10% are also being seen by a therapist that might be helping them? So how helpful really are these groups? You know, it doesn't seem like they're that helpful for many. I would argue that I'm sure there's, you know, there's some people, a small minority of people where they truly benefit from the anonymous groups and their philosophy. I think, you know, out of the pure kind of anonymous group follower, you know, the type that's not seeing a therapist on the outside or not receiving any kind of pharmacological treatment. I didn't even mention that. That's another possibility. Let's just say people that the small minority of people that do get better just from attending those groups. Who's to say it even has anything to do with those 12 steps and 12 traditions? Who's to say it doesn't have, it has only to do with the fact that they feel, you know, connected socially because there's a group there for them. And maybe that's it. Maybe that's the only magic of these groups. And again, for that, fine. I mean, if that helps you and you find that helpful, I am 100% for it. And we're also not, you know, from the stance, well, at least I'll speak for myself. I'm not from the stance to say that if you see me, and, you know, you're going to do my harm reduction approach, you can't go to an anonymous group. You certainly can. You absolutely can. You know? And if you want to go to these groups and sit in those rooms and that helps you out, in addition to the work that we do, that's fine. I have no problem with that. So that's the difference. The difference is, while us harm reduction therapists, you know, find or believe that these groups are not helpful for the large majority of people, we're certainly not against our clients or anyone for that matter utilizing them if they're helpful. Our main concern lies with all the people who don't find them helpful or find them uncomfortable or don't agree with their philosophy and just ultimately are not going to be helped by them. And that's the problem, that these people have nowhere to go. you know, I've had so many patients that have come into my office and have spoken the words, if I hadn't seen your YouTube video, if I hadn't known that there was an alternative kind of therapist or approach like yours, I would have never gotten treatment. Because according to what I knew, the only way to deal with this problem is to go to an honest group, and I knew that I wasn't going to do that, therefore I was not going to get treated. Isn't that a shame? Can you imagine? Can you imagine not getting, being receptive, here's the whole thing, being receptive and open to help, but not seeking it out because you only think that there's one method, that there's one option, and you don't like that option. You're open to help, you're open to treatment, but you're just not open to that kind of treatment. And that's a shame. You know, I'm sure if we look back in the history of medicine and everything else, there were other instances where they had this kind of archaic treatment that people said no to and were shunned for it, only to find out later that this treatment was not that great, and now we have all these other treatments that people can choose. So, yeah, I'm sure if you just think about that idea for a little bit, you'll come up with plenty of examples. So, you know, we're hoping, as these alternative therapists, you know, these us harm reduction therapists, we're hoping that in time people look back and say, gosh, man, that's all they had back then was just those anonymous groups? That was it? There was no other options? If you didn't like that approach, that was it? And like even your doctor would say, like, that's the only way to get help? Ugh. So hopefully years from now, we'll rewrite history, you know, and in a different way, in a more flexible way, you know, with options for these people. I have to tell you, in other parts of the world, the anonymous approach is not the go-to. It is not the go-to. And it's certainly not viewed as the only approach. I'll definitely say that. You know, it's interesting. For such a progressive country as America, in so many ways, you know, we're such a world leader in so many ways, in addiction treatment, there are so many, you know, I'm not going to get into all the different countries out there and the different, you know, regions of the world, but let me just tell you this. We are behind. We're behind in our, you know, approach to addiction treatment, in the sense that many other countries out there are way ahead of us. They're more progressive. They're using pharmacological treatment or medicine, if you will, more effectively to treat addictions. They're using, they're using therapeutic approaches in a framework that is similar to the harm reduction framework in a more flexible manner. You know, it's amazing how far behind we are with this whole addiction treatment. But, yeah, so that's my first podcast here. I'm thinking about keeping these down to about 30 minutes. Otherwise, I have this really awful habit of just rambling and kind of regurgitating information. But I will say this, you know, before I end, the reason why I came up with this title is, yeah, of course, you have addicted is in the title. But for my day job, I commute several hours a day. And I always find that, you know, when I'm in my little world and to myself, and, you know, my little Toyota Prius here, and, you know, I have all these thoughts that are occurring to me because I have, you know, nothing else to do but to just sit in this car. And, you know, at a certain point, you've listened to so many different, you know, songs. You know, I've listened to Spotify and Pandora ad nauseum, audiobooks ad nauseum. I'm sure I could come up with a few new audiobooks that would interest me, but at a certain point, yeah, you know, I like to view myself as a creative individual, as most of us therapists do. It is, you know, I think, in a sense, a little bit more of an art than a science. And, you know, there's this creative itch I have, and I want to create. So this is just like a great time for me to kind of spew out all my thoughts about this, something that I'm so passionate about. And yeah, I'm pretty excited about this. So stay tuned for my next one. I don't know exactly when that will be, but I'm hoping rather soon. Okay, stay well, and here's to great mental health.